Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Christian Reeve podcast. If you enjoy the show, please consider leaving a review on Podchaser, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to the show. It really, really helps us out in terms of pushing the show and giving it a fighting chance of just reaching the people and hopefully growing the show further and further. So if you'd like to help us out, those are the ways to do it. In addition, you can also subscribe to us on patreon.com/Christian Reeve and support my efforts in terms of bringing this show to you. Thank you so much and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Christian Reeve podcast. Today's guest is the co-host of the Leaving Eden podcast and also a musician. His name is Gavriel Hacohen. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Great. I'm happy to be here. It's 8 a.m. here in Philadelphia where I live, and I'm having a good start to my morning, and it's just a lovely Wednesday.
I appreciate you, man. I know how ridiculously early it is over there, so thank you for that. Do you know what's funny, actually? It's funny how the universe works sometimes, because I didn't plan on having a series of episodes about cults, but like, there was this show that's been planned. So for those, obviously, you guys that at home don't know about this, basically, we've been planning to do this show for a while. We've been rescheduling back and forth. Again, thank you for adhering to that. I appreciate you. I kind of just figured I would do a show about cults and then, you know, that would be it, right? But then I got this random message out of the blue from someone here in the UK about some cult thing called like Twin Flames, the universe. I'm sure you've heard about this. We can delve into it a little bit in a sec. But like, I was like, oh, okay. And I start going down that rabbit hole. And of course, with every type of thing, when you delve into it further enough, especially with cults, it's just thing after thing after thing after thing. And like, I'm only like maybe 75% of the way into my research for that show. But like, even with this, you know, I threw it out to my audience. They had naturally many, many questions. I have many, many questions. I guess like my first question to you is like, where do you even start with, you know, conducting your research and investigating a cult and like kind of knowing like what to focus in on?
So I can answer that question in two ways. The first way is like how it happened for me personally. Was just that during the pandemic, my friend and I decided to start a podcast, and she was raised within a very strict branch of Christian fundamentalism, definitely a branch of Christian fundamentalism that qualifies as a cult. And during the pandemic, you know, this was probably in like March or April or May of 2020, when everyone was either, you know, having a sourdough starter or getting really into knitting, or I don't know, deciding that they wanted to learn a new instrument. We were just like, let's start a podcast, because, you know, we both did music. And so we both had recording equipment at our respective houses, and we just decided to go from there. And when I started, I pretty much knew nothing. But I had a friend who was raised in this, and for the last 3 years, you know, we've been doing a show pretty much every single week for 3 years, and now I actually know quite a bit about it. So it really just comes down to finding people who can talk to you about it and finding information and just going down the rabbit hole over and over and over and over again for a very long time. I mean, when we first started the show, I was completely just... I had an idea of what I thought a cult would be and what I thought Christian fundamentalism would be just from growing up in the United States. And that turned out to, in some respects be true, and in other respects be totally way off. As far as where people who are starting out should go to try and learn the information that they want to learn about cults, I would recommend, there's a website called Freedom of Mind. Is it .org or .com?
Gotta be .org.
look it up right now. Yeah. There's a researcher, his name is Stephen Hassan, And he has come up with
almost like tenets or principles of what defines a cult, maybe.
Yes. He's come up with it's freedomofmind.com. You go to freedomofmind.com. There's a researcher named Stephen Hassan. He's come out with what's called the BITE model. And the BITE model is basically the way in which we define whether or not something is a cult. So BITE is an acronym for behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotion control. And a cult isn't determined by like, oh, how old is it? Oh, how many members does it have? Sorry, gotta adjust my microphone. How old is it? How many members does it have? How do they let you leave? Do they not let you leave? I mean, those could be aspects, especially the last one. But things like authoritarian regimes can count as cults if they enact these methods of coercive control to a high enough degree. A one-on-one abusive partnership could count as a cult if the methods of coercive control are enacted to a high enough degree. Like some of the examples of behavior control could be anything from like if you are part of a religious group that tells you how to dress, that's an aspect of behavior control, but that doesn't necessarily mean that any religion that would tell you how to dress is a cult, because a lot of times that's just, you know, how people who are members of that religion dress, and that's not necessarily coercive. What could be coercive is if the dress code is enforced by strict rules, or is enforced by a culture of guilt or a culture of shame if you don't do this thing. Or, you know, another example of behavior control would be something like controlling who you can and who you can't have sex with. Things like, so you were talking about the Twin Flame documentary, you know, they were encouraging people to be in relationships and partnerships that are,
you know, the crazy thing about that documentary,
yeah,
was like, I'm just sitting there doing research, and naturally I'm seeing the same things that I've seen in other like cult kind of situations, but the first thing that came to my mind is, oh, this is like that Nixium cult. Like, this is like almost exactly like, even down to the structure, the fact that it kind of resembles a multi-level marketing scheme. Because like, that's another thing as well. All of these cults, they pretty much always have that element to it, to kind of draw people in, give people, you know, something to work towards, some sort of system they can follow, which keeps them in that, you know, over a longer period of time. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned some of those things there in when you were kind of outlaying it. Like, there's these things that keep coming up every time. A particular leader, or, you know, like in the Nixium cult, everyone in that cult seemed to kind of revere this man as something special. Like, you know, he's a really talented mathematician. He's this, he's that. Like, when he came in the room, it was like, everyone reacted in a certain way, you know. And it's similar with this Twin Flames thing, where this couple, especially the man in this coupling, I mean, does he, I think he referred to himself as God at certain points, or he wanted his followers to refer to him as like God, which that blew my mind. Because, okay, fair enough, you know, it's not the first time we've ever heard of a cult doing that, like members within a cult doing that, but like, it's kind of like he was testing the waters every couple of years. It's like, okay, I'm gonna throw this at them and see how they react. And of course, with the whole religious element to it, that particular cult didn't start as a religious cult, but then they started adding those elements because, you know, they were trying to avoid taxes, they were trying to, you know. And this is such a huge thing in the States that blows my mind, this idea that there are some organizations, huge, I think they call them evangelists, yeah, or televangelists, like, well, church organizations that completely avoid tax.
Well, I mean, any nonprofit organization,
right,
have to pay taxes. So like if I started a foundation to, I don't know, raise money for poverty, for mm-hmm. you know, for homeless people, that would be a nonprofit organization and I wouldn't have to pay corporate taxes. But if I was employed by that organization, I would still have to pay income tax.
Right.
So, I mean, that's how that works. And it is like the tax law about that. That's, I mean, how many of these things are motivated by money? I know that like there's a lot of these Christian fundamentalists or the televangelists, especially the televangelists these days don't tend to be as fundamentalist. They tend to be a bit more wide reaching because they want to cast a bit of a wider net.
There was that guy during the pandemic. He'd been around for years. The guy that like almost like resembles the devil. It's kind of scary. He's awesome. Really, really, really famous, like pastor in televangelist.
Yeah, was it Joel Osteen?
Did it say his name again?
Osteen.
No, it's a different name. It was the guy during the pandemic that was famous for kind of like holding his hand towards the screen and being like trying to heal people of COVID from like through the screen. It was really weird. But basically, I read into his particular organization, let's leave it there, and he's like, they're billionaires. He flies around in a private jet, and there was a famous interview of him from a few years back where the interviewer is saying like, you know, do you really think it's right that you have like a private jet? And he said something along the lines of like, oh, you know, this guy made it possible for me to get a private jet and I just couldn't say no. And then there's a bit where she's really trying to push him, like, but not like too harsh, like quite standard for a journalist, and she's making some really solid points, and he's trying to flip the conversation and make it seem like she's harassing him. And he gets particularly aggressive when she questions his treatment of other people and how he supposedly, like, allegedly had referred to some of his followers as being like devil worshippers, heathens, stuff like that. And he's like, I didn't say that. I never said that. Like, he's very like just aggressive with it. And that kind of goes back to what we were saying before about this idea of control within cults, controlling your behavior, controlling how you speak, controlling history. You know, like, it's almost like revisionist history. It's like, no, that didn't happen. You just think this happened.
Like, well, that's kind of for information control. One of the big aspects is you can only get information from approved sources,
right?
Which, like, if you're part of whatever their version of state media is, so their newsletter, or from the pastor that says, you know, say that there's a scandal where, I mean, most of these places, wherever you have a level of coercive control, there's going to be somebody who sees that and takes advantage of that and does, usually will sexually abuse people who are weaker than them, who tend to be people like teenage girls. Because in religious fundamentalism, that's basically the bottom of the food chain, as far as who has power. And when people come forward, you know, they're victim blamed. And it's, that didn't happen. The devil is attacking me. The devil is attacking this congregation. And even if it did happen, it's, well, I stumbled into sin because you guys out here were not holy enough. And if you guys aren't holy, then, you know, then I'm going to be tempted into sin and there's nothing that I can do about it.
There always seems to be this like competition element as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm the better follower. I'm the better whatever. There's always that competition element, and they encourage that.
Yeah, I mean, against each other, to win the approval, to win the love, to win the loyalty. It's I mean, it's classic manipulation. You were saying something earlier that made something pop to me, and I'm trying to remember what it was. You were talking about prosperity gospel. So you're are you religious? You're not
Christian. No. I would say I'm kind of like a very open sort of spiritualist, but I keep myself open to all anything and everything. So I think that the bigger issue I have is this idea that you have to kind of only believe in one thing. Like, you're not allowed to believe anything. Like, I hate anything that tells you, like, no, you have to be in this box and do exactly what you're told. Like, I think that human beings, you know, we should have a freedom. We should be able to choose what resonates with us within our belief systems and stuff, but always keep ourselves open to, like, possibilities and ideas.
So you're not super familiar with, like, Christian theology?
Base level understanding of it, you know, like the standard stuff.
You know that, like, the main thing is, like, you're a sinner and Jesus takes away your sin. That's right. Like on the base level for Christians. Mm-hmm. There's other sub levels of theology where, depending on what branch, depending on what type of church you go to, there's this one sort of, I would call it almost like a pseudo theology called prosperity gospel, where essentially they believe like that it comes from a belief that God is very active in your life, in the day-to-day aspects of your life, rather than just being like kind of a big thing that's out there and watching for like the big things, but not really paying attention to the little things. There's a belief that like every single interaction that you have and every single good thing or bad thing that happens to you is controlled by God. And so when they see people who are very wealthy, or people who are very wealthy who are also very religious, might get a bit of a complex about, I have this wealth, I have all of these possessions, I am so blessed because God has chosen to bless me, and God would only choose to bless me if I were a really good person, if I were like a really holy and a really devout person. And if you're a pastor, I mean, people who choose to make their livings in the ministry, mm-hmm, often live in, if they're from a fundamentalist branch of Christianity, they're often, you know, not very wealthy at all. They're often, quite often, they're living in poverty with their families, because they have to have a good sized family in order to show that the Lord is blessing them with children. But also, yeah, no, that's a belief. Especially in Christian fundamentalism, there's this whole thing. Do you know who the Duggars are?
I can't say I do.
The 19 kids and counting family. That's its own whole thing that we could talk about later. That having more children is a sign that God is blessing you, because there's this verse in the Bible that says something like, children are arrows and happy is the man who hath his quiver full of them. And so there's this whole set of teachings known as quiverful, where basically you have to try to have as many children as possible because that's what God is telling you to do. So a good number of Christian fundamentalists in the United States adhere to this belief, like a lot of families. And so there will be families with many, many children. And because they have so many children, and if they decide that they want to, that they're the, if you're a minister, you have to be the ones who are setting an example for everyone else. So you have to be the most devout. And the way that you would get your income is basically from the tithing of all of the people in the church who are giving money to you.
Right. But that's where the MLM stuff comes into play.
Right. But if you're part of a church and you are, you know, a church plant in a town that only has, you know, a couple thousand people in it, like, mm, if you're one of these small towns in America and there's no denominational oversight that's giving you the money to live off of, and you're an independent church, which a lot of these churches are independent churches, then you don't have a lot of money coming in. And so you look at your church and you say, God, please bless me and bring me a larger flock, you know, because that would allow me to do so many great things in the world and save so many people. And then you look over at somebody who has a church that has 1,000 members or 10,000 members, and you could say, wow, they have all of these nice things, and people are coming to their church to hear them speak, God must be blessing them. In like in evangelical Christianity, in America at least, it's a very much a culture of bigger is always better.
Sure.
I
think that the internet element comes into play here, because remember when I was watching the end of that Twin Flames universe documentary on Netflix, which everybody go out of your way to check that out. It's fascinating. They mentioned, and I've seen these statistics before, but it said basically like there's about 10,000 cults, give or take, in the United States alone. And there's been like an influx of them since the pandemic. And of course, you know, just in general with the advent of the internet over the last 20, 25 years. And it's like, to your point before, you know, where you were restricted by, oh, well, our town only has this many people and maybe this percentage are Christian, etc. Now, that doesn't matter because you've got the internet. You can pull people in there. I mean, in that Twin Flames documentary, you had people from all around the world as part of this cult. And they were moving, like, you know, state by state to be with their, you know, designated Twin Flame, or, you know, moving country even, you know, in order to facilitate this. So they really had like quite a lot of power over these people through the internet.
Well, and that sort of, if you're doing it on the internet, then that's going to even more rely on you having that personality that is big enough personality. Like, I was watching the Twin Flames doc, and that couple that started it, and they're just like, we're the best couple. I was just like,
dude, okay, didn't like, you think like,
that's the thing is that people like, but they're not the only ones that do this. They're like, if you do XYZ thing, you could have a relationship like us. It's like, you ever look at like, the like influencers who are like making,
I know where you're going with this.
Content, and they're like, if you do XYZ thing, then you could have a marriage, like marriage influencers. I don't know. It's like the whole wife guy conundrum.
The best part about that is that, like, and yeah, I know that they would have cut this, the documentarians have cut this up, and you always have to be careful of this when you watch the documentary, guys, that like it fits a certain narrative, and that doesn't always mean that the documentarian is trying to push you a certain way, but a lot of the time they are. But with this, there's so much footage over the last like sort of 10 years of these people, and their relationship is not good, man. Like, from the get-go, you see an old clip of them from maybe like 7 or 8 years ago where, as you say, you know, they're like, we're the best couple ever and we're so in love. And it's like, but they're not. You can already see the red flags there in like their mannerisms or the weird body language that they give off and stuff. Like, there's something amiss. And to your point about influences, it makes this notion of like, protest too much. You're pushing this narrative like, I'm so happy, everything's great, don't you want to be like me? And it's like, if you are happy, you don't need to necessarily go out and tell the world every 5 seconds. Like, I don't know, there's something about that I feel is off.
That's what it is. You know, anytime you see a celebrity who's like, my marriage is perfect, and that's their brand, that their marriage is amazing, or that their relationship is amazing, and they're like a guru of relationship, you're just like,
Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith comes to mind.
Or do you remember?
Jada. Is it Jada? Yeah.
It's Jada. Do you remember the Try Guys, the Ned Fulmer Try Guys cheating scandal?
It rings a bell. I don't know. Can you lay it out for us real quick?
There was a YouTube channel, or there still is a YouTube channel, where there was basically these four guys that would try different things. Like, they'd be like, oh, we're going to try really spicy food, or we're going to try like it's a solid YouTube channel. I actually highly recommend you go back and look at their back catalog of videos for because they made a lot of really entertaining content, and a lot of people were watching it during the pandemic, and it was actually really nice content to have during the pandemic, because it was kind of like people doing nice stuff but in a low stakes sort of way, and that was kind of what we felt. But anyway, like, one of the guys that was part of that group, and they had millions and millions and millions of people watching them. His whole thing was, he's like, I'm married and my marriage is fantastic. And You know, and you know, they'd like monetized this whole brand of them being, you know, not just them making content, but also their wives making content for the audience, because people had, I guess, this parasocial relationship with them.
Which you have to be so careful about. I've covered that on my show before. Like, anyone that's creating content, or if you have a following, like even if it's small, like I have a small following online, I have to be careful with what I say, how I do things, compose myself, etc., because you have a profound impact on people.
Yeah, whether you, I mean, like, I don't even, and also just for like privacy. Yeah, I mean, I don't even like, if I by accident say my girlfriend's name on a podcast episode, I make sure that I bleep that in the actual version that goes out, because I like, not even her first name, like. Mm-hmm. She's just a person who has a job, who's didn't consent to being a I mean, I have a our show has like a modest following, probably like 10,000-15,000 people. So it's not
amazing.
Like, yeah. So it's not as if it's, I'm like some big celebrity or anything like that. But
here's me with my like 10 followers. Like, yeah, come on, guys. That really is modest.
Yeah. I mean, but still, like, you have to be willing to do that. And some people, absolutely. I mean, I this is going to bring me back to fundamentalism, is there's this YouTube channel and content channel and various other things channel called Girl Defined. Are you familiar with them? So most of the stuff that I know about is Christian fundamentalism related. And there's this content channel called Girl Defined, which essentially what it's this a woman named Bethany and her sister Kristen, who are from one of these large and successful Christian fundamentalist families. Like they're families that have a lot of children and they're successful and they're not like living in poverty. And if you know, do that and you have, you know, maybe siblings that are in a ministry and have a certain level of success, then within this subculture, you'll kind of gain a reputation as not like a holy person, but like as a person who other people should model their lives after. So there's this woman named Bethany Beal, and I think she's just a couple of years older than me. I think she's like 34, 35, something like that. And she and her sister Kristen have been making content about, here's a woman and here's how to be a woman in fundamentalism. Here are good things to do. And if you're growing up in her particular branch of evangelical Christianity, which is the kind of branch where they're Christian enough that, you know, that they're not into gay marriage. They're not into, they think all homosexuality is a sin. They're mad about the woke agenda or whatever bullshit they're mad about. But they're not so Christian that if you saw one of them out in public, you would be like, that person is dressed kind of weird. Why is that person dressed weird? Like, they're not into the whole, oh, you wear skirts only, you don't wear pants, which is also very much a thing. In Christian fundamentalism. So it's very much like a middle ground between the extreme and, you know, how regular, you know, normal people who we think of as a Christian would live. And so their whole thing is that they're making content based on like, if you do XYZ thing, then your marriage can be as good as my marriage. And but like, that's what people do, is that people look and they see, it's the whole influencer thing, is they will look at you and they will see, oh, this person does XYZ thing. Oh, your photos are so aesthetic. They're so cute. They're so pretty. Your family looks so nice with your little blonde children. They're so cute. And they're like, here's what you do. Here's how you find a Christian husband. And they'll make all of this content based on that, but they don't really have the wherewithal to, because they're stuck in this Christian fundamentalism sphere, they are also limited in that they can't take influence from outside of that that might actually help solve some of the problems that Christians may be having if they decide that this is the kind of life that they want to live. And so you end up, I mean, like one of the biggest ways that this plays out is with sex, is that the way that this woman has and has made her content, she's basically pivoted to being like, from being like, oh, I do marriage advice, to saying, oh, I do sex advice. But
she's going to get more attention from a business perspective.
Right. You're going to get more attention because that's one of the things that people know about, especially if you're like, I don't have sex before I get married. If you're one of the people that doesn't do that, which a lot of people don't do, not just Christians, for various reasons. And you know what? That's up to them. I don't have any problem with that. I don't, you know, it's up to everybody to have sex with who they want to, when they want to. And that decision is up to them as long as everybody consents to it. But that's like a huge source of anxiety from people, especially if you're a Christian and you're living in a culture where sex is kind of everywhere. And you might get kind of a complex out of like, oh, I don't do this, but other people do this. And I feel like everyone knows everything that I do. But I've read quite a bit of the Christian sex advice content for the podcast that I co-host, because, you know, we'll do like a Valentine's Day episode and we'll read like a Christian sex advice book. And there will be some advice in there, but then there will also just be like, they'll beat around the bush and not really.
What's the strangest stuff you've heard that this is crazy?
Like, it's not even that it's crazy. It's that most of it will just be like the most vanilla kind of general speaking things, because they don't want to go in and say, okay, like they don't want to give explicit advice. What they'll say is they'll be like, make sure that you try to pleasure your partner. Okay, what the fuck does that mean? If you, I'm sorry, can I swear? Is it okay? But yeah, but like, what does that mean? If you don't know anything about sex, if you're from a culture that's like, sex is very taboo to talk about, and somebody gives you a book and they're like, make sure your partner is pleasured, especially if you're a man, make sure you pleasure your, like, what does that mean? Especially if you're also in a culture that tells women that they shouldn't speak up if they're unhappy.
That was one of the biggest things I saw in, sorry, I just keep going back to it because it's fresh on my mind, but the Twin Flames documentary, like, there was so many things in that that demonstrate the worst parts of like what a cult can be and how it manipulates its users. And a lot of it was just gaslighting people, telling them like, this behavior is wrong, this behavior is wrong, this behavior is wrong. Like, one of the biggest stories I'll just share real quick from that was, there's a girl, she's 19, she's very, like, you know, clearly very vulnerable, and she's joined this thing looking for someone, as most of the people are. Most of the people that join this particular cult, this Twin Flames Universe cult, they tend to be women between the ages of, say, 18, 19, up to, I don't know, maybe 40s, 50s, right? And, you know, they get sold on this idea, and they pursue it, and they go through all the ranks. And, like, this girl did that, and she was encouraged, and she was told that this particular random person that had commented in this Facebook group was her, quote-unquote, twin flame, some person that she felt uneasy about, she felt uncomfortable with, but she was pushed and told, no, this is right for you, this is what you want. And so this young girl is being pushed into this relationship, and she pursues it because she thinks it's the right thing. Excuse me. And, you know, this guy is into drugs, this guy gets done for possession of cannabis, he's, I believe he was on probation for like 11 months, and they still push her to be with this person. And every time something bad happens as a result of his actions, she's told to sort of just roll with it. And she moves in with this guy, and she's very clearly unhappy. And she's told, like, to, like, love this person, even though she quite clearly doesn't love him. And it's just so uncomfortable to watch. Like, I really recommend everyone go check it out, because it really shows you the extreme scenarios that can happen if you're part of a cult, and you're even if you're doubtful. Like, in so many of these videos, you can see people are doubtful, people are questioning, even in the beginning. You know, maybe they've been in this cult for a few years at this point, and they're still, but like, everything they put in you know, it's a bit like being in a bad relationship and you don't want to leave because you're, oh, but I, you know, there's so much that we've done together. Like, I don't want to just drop this all now. Like, you know, I don't want to give it all up now. And it's like, if it's bad for you, give it up. Like, but that's the thing, isn't it? Going back to what you were saying before, they want to keep you in. They want to keep that control. They don't want you to leave. Because if you leave, you know, they're not making money from you. They're not controlling you, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, that was an example that, to me, I mean, because with Twin Flames, one of the things that they were doing was they were telling people, it isn't just your relationship and your happiness that depends on this. It's everybody else's. It's that if you get into this relationship, then you can radiate that twin flame energy out to everybody else, and then that will help them find their person and get together with it. Like, it raises the stakes on everything, so it isn't just your relationship that you're fighting for, it's everybody else's. But what you were saying is that I would argue, and Stephen Hassan, who came up with the bite model, also believes this, is that abusive relationships, like abusive domestic partnerships, absolutely qualify as cults, in the same way that a group like the Branch Davidians would qualify as well, and that the techniques that are used to control a person when they're in a one-on-one domestic relationship are the same techniques that you would use to control a large group of people. So, like, the violence, the coercion, the, you know, the gaslighting, the, oh, that didn't happen. I mean, like, if you know, and I, you know, I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like this. I've never been in a situation like this, but I have many, many friends who've been in a situation like this where, you know, something bad happened where, you know, they were with a partner who was abusive, who was violent, who was cruel to them. And they would bring it up in an argument and say, you did this thing to me. You were cruel to me in this way. And they would say, that didn't happen. And, you know, say, oh, this didn't happen, or that didn't happen the way that you think it did, and really play games with your mind about. And that is a cult control technique that I've seen pastors use from the pulpit to say, oh, I didn't abuse that girl. That didn't happen. That wasn't real. The people who are saying that to you, the people who are telling you that, are lying to you, and you need to get them out of your life. And limiting who you can and can't have contact with, and who you can and can't get information from, is an aspect of information control, which is an aspect of cult control.
When I was on the receiving end of such a relationship, when I was in it, I remember kind of thinking, because I was consciously aware of what was going on, but I would make excuses. I would be like, well, you know, maybe it can get better. Sometimes this person's even nice. Like, you know, you gaslight yourself. They gaslight you, but you gaslight yourself. And it's only years later that I look back and I'm like, that's crazy, like, that I even thought that way. But the key thing that I remember, which is what I tend to notice in these cults, is that you're in a desperate situation, you're scared, you're fearful. When I look back, the biggest difference between now and then is now I'm not scared. If someone is toxic or whatever, I'm like, get the hell away from me, get the fuck out of my life. Back then, I didn't have the strength to say something like that or do that. There were times when I was close and I would say what I thought and I would try and get away, but I'd always end up back in the throes of it. Why? Because I was scared to be alone, because I didn't think I could live alone on my own by myself, right? Now, these cults, they prey on that. You know as well as I do. They latch onto that, and they basically take each person, isolate all of the different things about them that they can manipulate, and they zone in on that. And then when you try to, you know, pick at them for that and be like, listen, this is unhealthy what you're doing, they're like, well, you know, it's you know, it's of their own volition, they're doing it of their own choice, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, that is I just want to touch on this real quick. Like, obviously at the end of that documentary, after every episode on the Netflix one, they talk about, well, they were investigated, there's no sort of crimes or federal crimes that we can see that have been committed. And from a legal standpoint, it's true. From a moral standpoint, it's you know, terrible, awful what they're doing. But from the legal perspective, they've not broken any laws that I can see. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I'm not an expert on American law, but it's like they come into this group, they pay money and they join it, and they, you know, they make an income from it and so on. And I know specifically that pyramid schemes and MLMs is a bit of a gray area. Like, some forms are illegal. Some are, you know, they'll never call it that, but it will, they'll deliberately say it's not that when you know it's that. But it's tricky to like, where's the 100%, like, okay, you can't do this, but you can do this line when it comes to these, you know?
Well, to be good your lawyers are, that's kind of the thing. I mean, when you're talking about legal stuff, even if they do break the law, it's often very hard to get them for it. Like, so you've been watching the Twin Flames documentary. There's another cult documentary that came out called Investigation Discovery on HBO Max. I don't know if you guys have it over in the UK, have this one. It's called Let Us Pray, A Ministry of Scandals. And I have several friends who were involved in the making of that documentary. In fact, the branch of Christian fundamentalism that it's based on is the same branch of Christian fundamentalism that my podcast co-host was raised in. Wow. So, yeah, that's look it up. It's called Let Us Pray, A Ministry of Scandals, but pray is spelled P-R-E-Y, not P-R-A-Y. And recently we talked to one of the women who was very heavily featured in that documentary. Her name is Rachel Peach. And she spoke about how she was sexually abused as a child, as a teenager, by her youth pastor in her Christian fundamentalist church, and how difficult it was to get charges against him because she didn't come out with allegations against him until years and years and years and years later. And at that point, it's basically like, well, you don't have physical evidence of this thing happening. We don't have anything to go on other than your word. And in the United States, you know, in our court system, in our jury system, that's not good enough, especially when you have a system of abuse of like churches that will just kind of shuffle somebody from one church to another if they find out that some abuser. I mean, it's the same thing that, you know, that the Catholic Church got in so much trouble for doing with their priests. Christian fundamentalist churches will do that in America as well. But then they'll turn around and say, well, the Catholic Church is, that's where the pedophiles are. Because, you know, that's sort of their other thing. And she was eventually able to get charges, not just for herself, but for other women. Because somebody came forward with allegations about the youth pastor that had abused her, somebody who wasn't her. And this dude out of the blue texted her and said, we need to talk right now. I know X person talked to you, when this person hadn't talked to her. And she was able to, you know, when she was talking with the detective, she was able to record the phone call that she had with this guy and manipulate him into confessing. And she was able to get charges for not just herself, but for other people as well, using this phone call and basically getting him to admit that he did it. That's not common. Like, usually, you know, sexual abuse does not go charged, does not, or if it gets charged, there won't be enough evidence for a conviction, because what their lawyers will do is they will try to make the situation as emotionally scarring for the accuser as possible, right, for the victim possible. And so that they will drop the charges, or so that they will be like, no, I just can't testify. And then the person will get off. Or if they do get a conviction, the person will only get like 2 years or just like probation or something like that, because I think the laws are different for crimes that happened a longer time ago. And a lot of times there's also a statute of limitations. So if it happened more than a certain number of years ago, then there won't be then the law legally can't prosecute them, which is also kind of messed up. So that's sort of how it is, and that's why people can keep getting away with it, because it's not necessarily who, you know, how to plan the perfect crime so that you can get away with it. It's also picking the victim as somebody who you think isn't going to be powerful enough to actually bring consequences against you for the thing that you've done.
Well, bringing it back to cults, I imagine that that's kind of largely how they choose their followers. Yeah, or, you know.
I mean, like with the claims things, they picked people who were vulnerable, who were very, like, if you're a person who, you know, maybe you consume a lot of, you know, you grow up, you like romantic comedies or something like that. Or, and, you know, you grow up and you watch a TV show like How I Met Your Mother for years and years and years and years, and you connect with the characters, and you connect with a character who thinks that, like, the entire purpose of his life is to get married and to have kids.
Stop calling me out, man. Yeah.
Like, I want a nice life. I just want to be happy. And I just want to get married. I just want to have children. I just want to have a family. And you base your whole identity around that, then you're going to maybe let some things slide if you're just like, well, does this further this goal or does this not further this goal? Especially if you're just like, I don't know, like, if, because it's hard to find somebody who's attracted to you and who wants the same things as you. And so when you find somebody who maybe they find you attractive and they say that they want the same things as you, then you're going to overlook a bunch of other shit that is absolutely, you know, in a different situation if the stakes were lower, if you weren't basing your entire identity off of, you know, being like, I want to be in a relationship, I want to be married, I want to have children. Then the stakes would be lower and you would just be like, nah, fuck this. Like, I'm not dealing with this bullshit. Like, and that's one of the ways that abusers can kind of worm their way in and kind of, you know, stay in your life, even if you're just like, well, I should give this another chance. I should give this another chance. I should give this another chance. And that's actually, that brings me to the third aspect of cult control, which is thought control. And one of the aspects of thought control is adopting the group's map of reality as your own and installing black and white thinking and making people choose between, you know, good versus evil, us versus them, things like that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you can do that is when it's accepting the group's reality as your own, that can also basically be, you need to look at everything in your life through the lens of one goal. And that goal could possibly be, does this further my own personal goal of getting married and having children? Or it could be like, if you're in Christian fundamentalism, does this further the goal of getting the world saved before Jesus comes back? You know, and if something doesn't further that goal, then you don't do it. And if it, then you do it, or then you don't do it. And if something does further that goal, then you do it. And that's the one lens through which you look at every single action that you do. And it just basically makes you turn everything into an action that's either good and in favor of this or bad or not in favor of this. And that's one of the ways that cults can work. And it can make you, you know, stay in a potentially bad situation or support even heinous acts. Because, like, for example, how pastors keep getting away with this, with like sexual abuse and stuff, is they can say, this is a powerful pastor, this pastor has a big ministry, and this pastor has saved a lot of people. And if you come forward with your allegations of abuse against this pastor, then that will damage this pastor's ministry, and that will make it so other people don't get saved by Jesus. And when they die, if they don't get saved by Jesus, they're going to hell. If we can't get America saved, we need to save America by saving everybody in America, because America has to save the world.
All right, this will sound like a naive take, but I have to say it right now. And I said it on my previous show that I had with John Morris, who was quite heavily involved with religious groups and got out of it. Like, the thing that just drives me nuts, like hearing this and talking about it, is this idea that, like, and I'm sorry to interject, but I just gotta like throw this in there. Like, these people explain away this stuff. And they're like, we're doing this for the greater good. We're doing this to protect the reputation of this pastor, this person that has all this following. And they built this massive organization with so many followers, etc. And it's like, yeah, but fundamentally, you're doing bad things. And like these few terrible things that you've done, like it's like a contradiction of all the good stuff you've done. You can't go, oh yeah, but like we did all this good stuff, so just ignore this bad stuff. Is that no, that's not the way that it fucking works. Like, you can't just explain that away as like, oh well, you know, that's just the silliness, that's just the little things, you know, ignore that, sweep it under the rug. Like, what the hell? And I realize there's a degree of naivety in what I'm saying. Like, I understand the way the world works. There is what we see, and then there is what is. And then there's, don't get me wrong, there's many things in life that what you see is what you get, and it's true and it's real and it's beautiful. But there's a hell of a lot more stuff that is just, quite frankly, bullshit marketing. You know, you're being sold a bill of goods. You're being sold something that is just not accurate, not true, not real. And I feel like a lot of the time that's the case with these cults or religious movements. You know, you're just being lied to.
Well, it's also this, it's exactly the same thing as what authoritarian leaders will do. Is they will say, like, if you go back and look at somebody like Hitler, and if you read a book like Mein Kampf, then what he is essentially saying is that every conflict in the world, every international conflict or every interpersonal conflict, can be boiled down to a race war. Or if you look at if you look at like what the Soviet Union or what Maoist China was doing, they were saying there is no conflict in the world that can't be boiled down to a class war. Or if you look at a country like Iran, what are the Ayatollahs saying? They're saying every conflict in the world, every conflict that we have, is a holy war. So you have like, there is one scope through which you can look at this thing. And the holy war thing, that's the same thing as like what the Christian fundamentalists in America will say when they want Christian nationalism. They will say, we need to have religious law in the United States. So, and because this will help get America saved, and this will further the cause of getting the world saved, so that when Jesus comes back, we'll all be ready. Like, this is a very real thing. This is a very real aspect of, I've even seen this in like, you know, business motivational people,
right?
When they're like, you know, you'll see some guy on like a alpha podcast or something being like, I decided when I was 17 years old that I wanted to be a millionaire, and I decided I would not do anything unless it furthered my goal of being a millionaire or a billionaire. And you know, that was my one goal, and that was the one thing that I wanted. And you know, it's just like, oh my god, shut up. But that's also very much a mindset that people will preach to people. It's the same thing with MLMs, where they will say, is this a positive thought or is this a negative thought? If you don't have positive thoughts coming out of your head, then how can you succeed in this business? You need to only think about positive things and only think affirming things and never have negative thoughts.
It's interesting you say that, because in the I keep bringing it up, but in the Twin Flames documentary, it was the flip reverse. It's like they wanted you constantly in a negative state, because if you were in a positive state, they weren't able to make money from you. But you're right. It's generally speaking, it's like you either think the way that we think, or there's a fundamental problem with you. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah. And I mean, that.
But just bringing up the business element as well, I think that's something great. I don't think I've ever touched on that when it comes to cults. Like, I'm sure you work for companies over the years where this happens, where like you go into a room and like maybe it's a training day or some shit. And you know what I'm going to say? Like, it's like, come on, everybody, let's get together. Let's say a mantra, or let's like dance together or something like that. And I'm like, I'm not fucking doing that. What is this?
Like, they've hired some cornball to like get in front of everybody. Yeah, I've worked in for corporate America before. Oh,
I think there's a lot of cult traditions in there that need to be questioned. to be honest.
I would absolutely agree with you. Like, you ever go on LinkedIn? You ever use LinkedIn?
Oh, dude, like, it's do you know what? It's very cultist. Because as soon as you start calling bullshit on stuff, people were like, oh, well, you just don't see the vision. Oh, well, you're just, you know, that's inappropriate. You're not seeing the bigger picture. It's like, no, this is bullshit. Like the whole thing that you see on LinkedIn where it's like someone posts a story and like some of these stories are just like fake and nonsensical.
Hell, it's so cringe.
Yeah. And it's like, don't get me wrong, I like to hear a good like comeback story or a good rags to riches story. Like, who doesn't? But like a lot of them are just manufactured marketing spiel designed to get likes and interaction and draw people into business. They're trying to sell you stuff, guys. But like, yeah, that you see so much of that. Like, there's a guy that I follow on YouTube. I've shouted him out a few times. He's really good. His name's Joshua Flake. And interestingly, to our conversation, he was part of a religious cult when he was a kid. He has a controlling family who he's kind of separated himself from because of their behavior and the narcissist. It's crazy how many levels he connects to like our conversation. But like what he does most of the time is he calls out corporate America for their bullshit and all these like terms that they bring up. Like lately there's been a lot of terms they're bringing up in the kind of war against people working from home. So there'd be like things like quiet quitting, I'm sure you've heard that, or is it quiet hiring? Like just buzzwords that don't mean anything. It's just basic, like it's just us versus the companies and vice versa. That's kind of the general ethos. And he always tries to push the narrative like, hey, you don't have to do what they tell you. Like there's options out there. Go find your own path. Like it's okay. Like just because some company is telling you you're a lazy person because you want to work from home, that's nonsensical. But there are people saying that. There are people, big heads of companies, CEOs even, that are saying like quite damaging things. And bringing it back to cults, like that's pretty powerful because they've got, you know, maybe tens of thousands of people that work for them that will believe in that and will believe it blindly because they're so hopelessly reliant on the system that they'll defend it no matter what, just like the Matrix.
Every job that I've ever had where I worked for like a big company, it was me versus the company in that how little work could I do versus how much money could I make? Like that's always been it for me, at least. Yeah. Like I've always just been like, I am here for a paycheck. Please don't ask me to do extra because I won't. If it's not like that's always kind of been my but then again, I also like, you know, I was also not shy about that. And that's also kind of why I didn't excel in that field because I wasn't willing to, you know, kiss people's asses about that.
Yeah, but that's such a big part of it, dude. Like I'm right there with you. I would be loud. I'd speak out and it gets you in trouble. And it's like, yeah, but I'm not going to kiss your ass for a promotion. If I'm going to get a promotion, it's going to be because I either worked hard for it or because, I don't know, I impressed you with my mindset and I've got some good ideas or some shit. It's not going to be because I was like, I believe in you and I believe in the business culture. And like, it's just bollocks, to be honest.
There was a certain amount of like, in the 2000s, early 2010s, when startup culture was not what it is now, that every time there was like a new startup, like the CEO or like the founder of that startup was like, this is the next hero that's gonna, you know, that's revolutionizing, you know, whatever and changing the game. Like you saw all those articles back then. I don't know how old you are. You have your hair. I don't have my hair. I'm 30. 30. Okay, you're blessed. I'm not.
No, you're looking good, man. You're looking good.
I know. I'm it's actually very nice, except for in the winter because you get cold really quickly.
Yeah, I was gonna say you got to wrap up warm, bruv.
Got my Eagles hoodie on right now, and it's got the Sherpa lining. But it was very much like, I mean, where every founder wanted to be Steve Jobs. Or they wanted, I mean, it's like the whole thing where, you know how every founder now, every like Silicon Valley founder wants to be Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And he can kind of get away with a lot of stuff because he is who he is. He's also like the richest person in the world, but he can also portray himself as a victim because he has all of these people who are just like, the system hates him. Like, that's the thing. You got to portray yourself as a victim, and you have to create that us versus them dynamic, which is an aspect of thought control, and make yourself into the victim, even when you're like the biggest, you know, I mean, even when you're like the New York Yankees or the LA Lakers or something like that. Like, you make yourself into that like underdog, even when you're absolutely not the underdog.
That's what blows my mind the most, when people were like feeling sorry for Elon. It's like, dude, the guy's worth like what some countries would hope to make in like 5 years. I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, come on.
I feel sorry for him because like he has a child that doesn't love him anymore. Right. So that's, I mean, but that's his fault. So yeah. Don't dead name your children. It's not very cool.
No, of course not.
Man,
I mean, okay, let's bring it back to some of the basics about cults, because we've kind of gone,
we've been on
we've gone in a lot of different directions, and I want to just kind of fire some basic stuff at you to kind of like break it down as far as like because the topic of this will be understanding cults. And I was very excited to kind of explore this with you, because there's just so many different aspects to this, as far as like some of the things you've laid out, like people control, why people do what they do, why people join cults. Let's start there. Like, okay, I know the reasons, you know the reasons, but like bringing an example, see, it's with the Twin Flames thing, it was obvious that why people join because they want to find love. And that's a very understandable goal. I understand that desperation, that want, that need. We've all been there, right? But then you get things like the Nixium cult as an example, which from what I understood, it's been a while since I've seen it, but like basically, and guys, go check it out. There's a really good documentary called The Vow, which breaks it down very well. And it's made by people who were in the cult as well, which is even more interesting. So there it was about betterment, constant self-improvement, which is something that, you know, is not a negative thing in of itself. But where it becomes negative is the obsession to kind of go through this particular structure that they have and pay all this money. And again, it always goes down to that, how much money. And there were a lot of people joining this particular cult who were like, broke out, like they had no money at all. They're like dishing out credit cards and stuff just so they can be part of this. And it's, well, like MLM
do that. That's like, that's a big MLM thing,
right? And it's so damaging when you're getting to a point where you're like joining what, and that, this is the interesting thing about the Nixium thing, is that a lot of people that joined that were very aware, like, oh, this is a bit weird, this is a bit culty. Like, they knew what they were getting into, but they still joined anyway. And this is what I want to explore with you. What do you think it is fundamentally that induces people to join cults? Like, what are the main reasons why they choose to join?
So what a lot of cults will do is they will take the questions that we all have about life, like how do I be happy, what is the meaning of life, what happens when you die, things like that, and they will say, we have all of the answers, and if you join our group, we will give you a perfect roadmap, we will give you like for every aspect of your life, and you won't have to make any decisions because we know what the right decisions are. I'm going to bring this back to Christian fundamentalism, because this is what I know about. There is this cult within Christian fundamentalism called the Institute for Basic Life Principles, or the IBLP, which was founded by a guy named Bill Gothard back in the 20th, in like the middle part of the 20th century. There was like a homeschooling aspect, and there was like a, these are the principles that you have to live by, where basically what he said that he did was he went through the Bible and distilled every commandment into the Bible down into a certain number of principles. And so there was a principle where, you know, and these principles correlated to a value. So there would be a value that would be like, obedience is a good value to instill in your children. Or accepting who you are, or the design principle was another one of them. So accepting that things are the way they are because God planned them to be that way. And then from all of these principles, he distilled what he said were laws and commandments, and said, this is how you educate your children with this homeschooling curriculum that I have designed to go with these principles. And if you join a group like this, they will give you an answer for every single question in your life. Like, what do I eat? What do I wear? Where should I live? When should I sleep? How many children should I have? How should I educate my children? What should I do if my children aren't obedient? What should I do, you know, in every, when I'm looking for a job, what should I do? And it just says you can essentially turn your brain off and not make a decision, because making decisions is difficult. Making life choices is really difficult. And what they'll do is they will promise you freedom from having to make those decisions, because you know what the right answer is.
That's such a solid point as well. Like, obviously, we've heard the term brainwash. And like, when I was, again, watching the Twin Flames documentary, guys, I promise it'll be worth it. Go check it out. I'll do a whole show with a guest who will talk about it. But it's just, it's such a good example of like cults and how they work. Like, of all the documentaries I've seen about cults over the years, I really think it's solid. Like, there was a point quite early on where one of the people that's quite high up in the organization was just talking about how she got out of a particular meeting in this cult, and she's like, she can't think properly. Like, she can't just construct basic thoughts because her mind is just like, just full of this crap, this like what she's been told, what she's been brainwashed with. And like you said, like, you're given all the answers and you're told anything outside of that is not the truth, is, you know, is wrong, is bad for you, etc. Like, I thought one of the most alarming parts of that particular documentary was the fact that like people were completely isolated from their families, which is a very normal practice in cults, particularly religious groups. But like, it's kind of terrifying, because like, even if your family is massively supportive of you, they still go, oh no, but these people, you know, they don't get it, they're not part of this, they're bad for you. And it's like, but how do these random strangers that you don't know, how are what they're saying the truth, and how is it that they, you know what's best for you over your family, who's been there for you since day one? Like, do you know what I'm saying? It's crazy how the manipulation works.
Well, that's true. And also, you know, it sometimes works the other way around, in that a lot of families will be members of a very fundamentalist or a very cult-like group, and they will say, you can't turn your back on your family. And that's an aspect of emotion control, where they will essentially leverage relationships that you have and the love that you have for people, and leverage that into keeping you from, you know, from leaving, or leverage that into getting you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise normally do. I mean, and emotion control and thought control are the two aspects of Stephen Hassan's bite model, where you get into like the self brainwashing, where you get into the, I have to do this, because that's a thing that you kind of have to do on yourself. It isn't something that other people can do to you. You have to kind of be willing to make that switch and to turn your brain off and to think about, I was talking to, we just came out with an episode, where we had a person on. Her name is Alora Dodd. She is, she's pretty popular on TikTok and Instagram. I think she's got like 500,000 on TikTok. She has an account called Online One Room Schoolhouse. And she was raised Christian fundamentalist. She's also autistic. And she was talking about how difficult it would be, or how difficult it is for people with autism to, when they get like a hyperfixation or they get like a special interest, to, you know, be in Christian fundamentalism, where, you know, say you're really interested in sharks or something like that, and you learn a bunch of stuff about sharks, and you know, you absolutely love sharks, and you have like a shark stuffed animal, and you're like a kid and you have a shark stuffed animal that you bring with you. But then you get told your interest in sharks is in some way demonic. Why are you feeling this way about sharks? You should be feeling this way about Jesus.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's like everything I've ever known is a lie. I can't trust anyone. I can only trust this one source kind of mindset.
I mean, it is. Yeah. And also, you know, I want to go and talk to like, or talk about like do you know anyone who's gotten out of like a Hillsong type church?
I don't believe. What is that exactly?
Hillsong is, it's an Australian branch of a Pentecostal, charismatic. Okay, no. That kind of church, and they're very well known for making Christian music.
Right.
The music aspect of emotion control is also a very big deal, in that, you know, that there is certain kinds of music that are, I mean, music and art especially is a deeply emotional genre. Mm-hmm. What they will do is they will make Christian worship music to try to get you to feel big feelings about Jesus. So they'll make songs that are intentionally very emotional sounding songs. Like, I know for a while back there in like the 80s, 90s, 2000s, like the Christian music all sounded like U2. And then for a while it sounded like, it was like kind of almost like hardcore, kind of like metalcore, that kind of thing was big for a bit. And then got into like the, oh, now it sounds like Mumford and Sons, and now all Christian music kind of sounds like Imagine Dragons. Like, but yeah, it's the kind of genre of music that is popular with as many people as possible because it has like these big emotional swells, and they'll use techniques. Yeah. You know, are you a musician yourself?
Yes.
Yeah. So they'll use techniques like key changes, and they'll use like popular chord progressions that are big in popular songs, that are used in a lot of popular like pop songs, and get you to like the feelings that you feel when you hear your favorite song. They want to get you to feel those feelings about Jesus.
I think also as well, just on a side note, yeah, it's probably by design, because they realize if we're going to get the younger generations, we have to update and be on top of what the trends are. So if the current style is Mumford and Sons, then that's what our particular music needs to sound like in order to get those generations. Because if we're still playing stuff that from like 50 years ago, we're going to be seen as that old archaic organization. Whereas if we're up to date, people will be like, oh, the church is cool, we're cool, like we should join, like, you know, that kind of thing.
I mean, some churches do that, and some churches go exactly the opposite. Some churches are like, the world has changed, the world's gotten worse, you know. And this is very tied in America, at least, with like the with like racism, and trying to go back to a time when there wasn't racial equality, or when, I mean, there isn't racial equality, but when racial equality was much worse in America,
right,
and before women had, you know, before the women's lib movement, before the LGBTQ rights movement came in, and they're like, we need to go back. The world is getting more and more sinful. And as the world gets more and more sinful, we need to distinguish ourselves from the world by showing that we are holy, so that other people, when they're seeing us, when we're out, you know, soul winning and knocking on doors and asking people to come to church with us, they will see, oh, these people are different. These people are Christians. They're identifiably Christian when you look at them. So when they see us, they know that we are living the truth. And that's kind of how they do it. How some churches do it, like especially the old school American fundamentalist branches, that's very much a thing for them. They will instill a dress code where maybe the dress code won't be based on something from the Bible, but it will be based on the idea from the Bible that Christians are a peculiar group of people. I think that's the verse. And they're distinguishable because they're different and because they're kind. And so you have to be out here distinguishing yourself from the world, from the sinful world, because if people see you engaging in something that they think might be sinful, then they will look at you and they will say, oh, well, that person can't be for real Christian, because I saw them doing this. So they must not actually love Jesus that much, and it must be a fake.
You know, what's intriguing about that as well, what you were saying, the idea of soul winning. And
yeah,
like I've seen that in person. You know, I've got friends with different backgrounds, and a lot of my religious friends are just like normal everyday people. They follow what they believe. They don't try and shove it down your throat. Great. That's how I think we should all be. Your beliefs, to be honest, are quite a personal thing. And I don't think there's anything wrong with sharing your beliefs, but I think if someone says to you, hey, sorry, I'm not interested in that, then just respect that, right? Very, very simple thing. But here's the thing, you get people out on the street, and like, I remember this when I was a kid, like walking around with like my mum, and then there'd be like some guy on a street corner going like, you're heathens, you're going to hell. And I'm thinking, for what? I'm 3 years old, what have I done? And that's obviously the extreme side of things. But here's the interesting element to that is you've got these people, they're constantly out, they're constantly trying to, you know, convert people, bring people over. And I think so long as you do that in a manner that's like not forceful or pushing or trying to demean people, then you're okay. You know, you should have the freedom to do that. But like, you get these people where it's like a losing battle, where they'll be walking around, say, like a shop. Like, for instance, I live in Manchester in the UK, right? So we have a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds, races, religions, etc. We also have a long strip in the middle of the city center where religious people will go. Sometimes they'll preach, sometimes they'll just have music playing in the background, like whatever. It's quite interesting, to be honest. And you get like Mormons going around, for example, and they obviously stick out like a sore thumb because they're very, you know, the way they dress, the way they hold themselves is very different to how the average UK person walks down the street and dresses, right? And often the response they'll get is they'll get told to F off, you know, they're just, that's it. That's it's quite brutal, but you know, people just want to do their shopping, I guess. And, you know, I was talking to my housemate about this, and he was saying that like, apparently a lot of the reasons why they get their followers sometimes to do that is kind of like a punishment complex in order to like keep them more obedient, because they know that then probably not going to get any new followers by doing that. It's going to be quite an ineffective method, but they push them to do that in order to maintain that level of control and to keep them grounded, because in the minds of those people, potentially they'll look at that and come back and be like, wow, there's so many sinners out there. Like, you know, we're fighting a losing battle. What are we going to do? Kind of like mindset, you know?
That's absolutely accurate. I would definitely say that's accurate. You know, my podcast co-host Sadie, the branch of fundamentalism that she was in, she went to a Bible college in Northwest Indiana, in the United States. And what they would have her do, and people who went to the Bible college, and this is like a Bible college, like if you don't know, it's like an unaccredited school where you go, it's basically boot camp if you want to be in the ministry in this particular branch of fundamentalism. So they would put them all on a bus and send them to the nearby metro area, which was the Chicago metro area. And she would be walking around, knocking on doors in the south side of Chicago, in East Chicago, which is, as like a 19-year-old with like a friend, she and like a friend of hers would be walking around, knocking on doors in like East Chicago or south side Chicago, which are not particularly safe places. And just knocking on doors and, you know, asking people, when they answered the door, said, hello, if you died today, do you know 100% one way or the other if you would go to heaven?
I'm just throwing out trash, man. Come on, just give me a break.
Out and you do that time and time and time and time and time again, and you feel so defeated when you only get like one or two people to like say the prayer with you and you know, accept Jesus or whatever, and then you come back to this group of people who all have the same experience as you, and they can all sort of co-commiserate with you and be like, you know, and maybe there's somebody who's really good at it, and that person gets like 10 or 15 people to say the prayer with them, and or might even get some people to agree to come to church with them, which is always, you know, which some people can do, like, you know, if you harangue people enough, then they'll do that. But that is definitely a method of keeping people in. The soul winning thing is absolutely crazy to me. I do have another story about that.
That's right.
That happened to me recently is, if you know about like Christian fundamentalists, then you know that they're often very hardcore about their doctrinal beliefs, about what the Bible says, what the Bible doesn't say, what's a commandment, what's a, like their theology in extremely niche ways. And so I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And in major cities in America, and I mean, you saw this in Manchester, there are corners or there sometimes public places where people will, you know, have a megaphone and just be, you know, street preaching. And there's a guy that does it near the subway station that's by my house.
Yeah.
It'll always be out there. The other day, I was walking to the grocery store, and there was this guy. The guy was out there with his megaphone. There was a different guy on the corner across from him with a megaphone, and they were yelling at each other about like really niche doctrinal, like theological, like, and if I didn't have the knowledge that I have from like studying this for years, I would have been like, I have no idea what these guys are talking about. But one of these guys was like screaming at the other one because he, what in like one of the Bible verses that he was saying, he used a version of the Bible that wasn't the King James version of the Bible. And if you know anything about Christian fundamentalism, a lot of them believe that the King James version of the Bible is the only valid translation. And there's some like very weird beliefs that the translators of the King James version were given special powers by God to translate it perfectly and make it so that it's God's word in English, perfectly in English, so that they can just go through and be as like take things as out of context as they possibly can and say, this is a commandment from God because this is the words that God chose to put in this version of the Bible that we know is inerrant in English. And if you use a version of the Bible that isn't the King James version of the Bible, then they believe that you're leading people astray from the actual word of Jesus. And that, you know, and that if, I mean, some of them even believe if you get somebody saved and you don't use a King James version of the Bible, then it's then like that person might not actually be saved and that person might not actually go to heaven, which is kind of wild to think about because the King James version of the Bible was written in 1611. And it's crazy to think that nobody who spoke English before 1611 got saved to go to heaven. But that's like a whole story. But like they will get so niche about their theological differences with each other, even different fundamentalists with each other that believe 99.99999% of the same things, that they will get into heated arguments about these things, and they will basically like disfellowship each other over the most niche disagreements. Because, you know, because, well, if you don't believe exactly what I believe, I can't be 100% sure that you're actually saved, because I know that what I believe comes from God. And if you believe something different, then that means that doesn't come from God. Like, it's crazy.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Christian Reeve podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on Podchaser, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to the show. If it's on YouTube, please subscribe, like, share, comment, all of that jazz. It really, really helps us out in the algorithms as far as pushing the show and getting this show out there to more people. So thank you so much for your support. And also, if you'd like to get yourself some bonus content and support me in the process, go to patreon.com/Christian Reeve. Thank you so much. I'll see you in the next one.